Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here, early. Right now at Wayfair, get up to 70% off everything you need for the season ahead. Save on kitchen and dining, bedroom furniture and mattresses, holiday decor, and way more. Now is the time to score big, from seasonal finds to favorites you'll use all year long. Plus, with Wayfair, enjoy fast and easy shipping, with delivery in time for the holidays. Save up to 70% off early Black Friday deals. Shop now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Black Friday, wow, shop Wayfair now. Month-long big deals, yeah, these are steals.
70% less money spent.
You can't go wrong, check out this song. Festive decor, Black Friday score.
Garlands and trees,
saving with ease.
Lights for your house, lamps for your spouse.
Save at Wayfair.
On dining chairs, mattresses, two sheets, that are you. Everything home, these things in chrome. Here's a good clock, area roads. Fast shipping, wow, Wayfair is how.
Win the season, win the win the season.
Wayfair, 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 Wayfair.
Okay, so let's dive in. Our topic today, it's Harry Footman.
Right, Footman, a name that really resonates even now.
And according to the sources we've got, this guy was, well, huge back in the early 30s. Just absolutely massive.
A genuine cultural phenomenon, yeah.
Yeah.
The kind of fame that's hard to even grasp today in some ways.
Totally. Like one source actually calls him the Justin Bieber of the 1930s, which, you know, gives you a sense of that scale, that kind of immediate, overwhelming star power.
Well, that specific mix of charm and relatability, he hit a nerve.
But that's not really why we're talking about him, is it? It's not the fame itself.
No, not at all. It's how it all ended. Or rather, how it didn't end cleanly. His rise just stops. It crashes into this really baffling, frankly terrifying disappearance.
And it all seems to pivot around something the records call the impossible confession.
Exactly. And that phrase, the impossible confession, that's pretty much the heart of what we're digging into today. It's the line in the sand.
The line between
the record and the legend. That's our mission here, really. We've got this pile of sources, details on his career, that final album, The Chase, the whole mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to carefully, rigorously try and separate things out. What are the verifiable facts? You know, the dates, the things we know existed, the concrete stuff. That's the record.
Okay.
And then there's the legend. That's the story that grew up around the facts, the big dramatic narrative full of, well, theatrical details and these claims that just seem impossible.
Gotcha. So fact versus folklore, basically.
Pretty much. And this Footman case, it's almost a perfect example. It shows you celebrity worship.
Yeah.
How it can curdle into something else. Into dread.
From love to fear.
Yeah. And how rumors, especially really juicy ones, can somehow harden over time and almost become accepted as historical fact. It's a fascinating process.
And the source material we have, it's compelling stuff, but definitely unsettling. It maps out this journey from, like, bright pop sensation.
Yeah, the voice everyone loved.
To this figure tangled up in, well, true crime lore. And it feels like it happened almost overnight.
The transition is incredibly abrupt in the telling.
So we're looking at how this pop idol, this guy who was maybe a source of comfort during the Depression, you know, how he didn't just fade away. He seems to have orchestrated this exit.
A final dramatic act, yeah. One that guaranteed he'd be remembered, but not as a star, as an urban myth.
And it all hangs on this one thing, doesn't it? His last album, this piece of music that the story goes, was basically a confession.
A very disturbing, very public confession to some terrible things. That's the claim.
Okay, let's get into it. Where does the story really begin? The rise. Right, so looking at the start, the sheer scale of Harry Footman's fame, it's kind of breathtaking when you read about it. He wasn't just popular, he was, like, everywhere.
Ubiquitous is the word the sources often use.
Yeah. In 1933, his first album comes out. And boom, instant massive success. The accounts say he was just catapulted to the absolute top.
Overnight stardom, essentially. Became the voice, and maybe more importantly, the face for millions of people.
And this is the 1930s, right? The Depression. A really tough time.
Exactly. Economic hardship, social anxiety.
Hmm.
And along comes Footman. He represented something light, charming, a kind of accessible escapism.
People needed that.
Desperately. And understanding the media back then is key. No internet, no 247 TV news. It was mostly radio, maybe some newsreels at the cinema.
Much more limited channels.
Right. So when a star like Footman broke through, his impact was incredibly concentrated. He wasn't just famous in certain circles. His voice, his image, it was piped directly into people's homes.
So everyone knew him. Everyone felt like they had a relationship with him.
Absolutely. Which established this huge level of public affection, but also crucially a kind of psychological investment. People believed in his goodness, his charm.
He wasn't just a singer, he was a symbol, maybe a symbol of hope, or just normalcy in a difficult time.
Precisely. He became shared cultural property, in a way. And when someone reaches that symbolic status, any change, any deviation from that image, it hits differently.
It's not just a career move.
No. It feels personal, like a betrayal of that shared understanding. And the sources we have, they all highlight this shift starting a few years after his debut, maybe around 35, 36.
Okay, what kind of shift?
Both his public behavior, apparently, and definitely his music. It started to change. Those early, easygoing, charming songs, they started giving way to stuff that's described as brooding, psychologically intense.
That's a big jump from escapist pop.
A huge jump. And this transformation, this darkening, it's absolutely essential for the legend that follows. The narrative needs the charming idol to turn into something darker, something sinister.
To make the later events make sense, narratively speaking.
Exactly. It provides the setup for the fall. If he just stayed the same charming guy, the story wouldn't have the same power.
It feels like that classic story, you know? The idol with feet of clay. But maybe accelerated by the intensity of 1930s fame. That pressure cooker.
Could be. The public wants, or maybe expects, this kind of flawless persona from their stars, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially back then.
Yeah, someone uncomplicated to admire.
So when that mask slips, or in Footman's case, when the music itself starts hinting at something really dark underneath, the reaction isn't just disappointment. It becomes something closer to revulsion or dread.
Because he wasn't just changing his style. He was changing the very thing people liked him for. That safe, easy charm was replaced by something unsettling.
Right. He went from being easy escapism to representing the kind of complex, uncomfortable depths people were trying to escape from.
That's a profound shift in his cultural role.
And it's that shift from adoration to this kind of cultural dread that really cements the myth.
Yeah.
Think about it. A star who stays popular and just, I don't know, retires gracefully.
Mm-hmm.
They might be remembered fondly, but they fade. But a star who performs this kind of violent public break from their own image, especially right before vanishing, and especially if that break is linked to rumors of actual crime, that person becomes immortal.
Because the betrayal is so complete.
Exactly. The public needs a reason, a powerful story, to explain why their idol let them down so spectacularly. And the shift towards this darker, sinister music provided that disturbing answer even before the police officially got involved. It set the stage.
So here's a question maybe for you, the listener, to think about. At what point does that public image, that carefully built persona, the initial charm, the big success, become so dominant that it just overshadows whatever the real person is going through?
Was the darkness we hear about in the later music reflecting something that was always there, just hidden?
Or did the pressure of being America's clean-cut hero actually create the cracks? Did it force this darker stuff to come out in his art? It's impossible to know for sure, isn't it?
We can only look at what the sources say happened next. And the sources say the music got, well, the word they use is creepy.
Creepy. Not just different, but actively unsettling.
Yeah. And that description, that feeling it provoked, it signaled that the whole relationship between Footman and his audience had fundamentally changed. It had soured.
It prepared people psychologically for what came next.
I think so. It laid the groundwork for the Bombshell album. It suggested the betrayal wasn't just a sudden snap, but maybe something calculated. Even perhaps something the artist himself was perversely celebrating in his work.
Huh.
Which brings us right to the core of it. The absolute turning point. This is where the historical record, the facts, get tangled up almost beyond repair with a legend that's starting to spin up.
And that's the release of the album, Guilty as Charged.
Guilty as Charged. Came out, according to most sources, in the latter part of 1937. And this wasn't just, you know, a new sound for him. This felt different. It felt like an act.
An act of what?
Provocation, maybe? Dropped right into the mainstream. A deliberate challenge, it seems.
And the thing that immediately made everyone sit up and take notice, more than notice, really, was the track list, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. That's the detail that yanks this whole story out of music reviews and straight into, well, true crime territory.
Because every single song title on the album,
yeah,
it was a person's name.
Yeah. Not concepts, not feelings, not fictional characters, just names. Mm-hmm. First and last names. John Smith, Mary Jones, that kind of thing. Dozens of them.
Just imagine getting that record in 1937 from this huge star whose image is already starting to feel off. Sinister, even.
The audacity of it is stunning. It's an immediate, unmistakable signal. This isn't your standard collection of songs. This looks like something else entirely.
Like a list or evidence.
Potentially. Yeah. And it basically created this trope we see sometimes even now, the confession album. you know, where art is used to hint at or directly state some kind of personal darkness or wrongdoing.
But back then, in 1937, that must have been shocking. Unheard of.
Truly unprecedented for a mainstream star. And the sources say people didn't just listen, they studied the lyrics. Apparently, they were full of these mundane little local details.
Like what?
Things like a specific street corner in his hometown, the make of a car seen somewhere, a particular storm that happened the previous autumn. Really specific, grounded references.
Which made it feel real.
Exactly. Less like art, more like reporting, almost. And the overall effect was described as so creepy, so deeply unsettling.
That people called the police.
Yeah, that's the detail that always gets me. Listeners didn't just write angry letters to the editor or complain to the record company. They picked up the phone and called the actual police. They felt something was genuinely wrong.
Connecting the songs to things they remembered. Local news, maybe?
Apparently so. Linking the names on the track list to people they knew or stories they'd heard locally.
Wow. That reaction itself is extraordinary. For music to provoke that kind of civic action, it tells you how much this struck a nerve.
It does. It suggests the album felt like documentation, not just expression. For a 1930s audience, without the internet flooding them with information daily, to feel that strongly compelled, it shows the impact Footman still had. It was like a betrayal amplified by his fame.
A kind of cultural trauma delivered via vinyl?
You could say that. But then there's another layer, something even stranger, right on the album sleeve itself. This is where the deliberate myth-making seems to kick in.
You're talking about the date?
The date? Our source materials all point this out. The release date printed on the album, or associated with it in early reports, wasn't normal. It was listed as October 32, 1937.
October 32nd, that's not a real date.
Nope. Doesn't exist. Never has.
So why? A typo.
Unlikely. Given how specific it is and how consistently it's mentioned in the lore, it's almost always cited in retellings. They call it a cursed stamp detail or a mythic signature.
Like a deliberate glitch in the matrix.
Exactly. As a methodologist, you look at that not as a mistake, but as a choice. Maybe art direction, maybe something else. But when you label your artifact with an impossible date, you're immediately lifting it out of normal reality.
You're signaling. This isn't playing by the usual rules.
Precisely. It tells every future listener, every reader of the story. This thing, this confession, it exists slightly outside of time and space as you know it. It instantly elevates the album and the story around it to myth.
It gives it that little touch of the uncanny, the unreal, that makes folklore stick. It's almost more powerful than the lyrics themselves, in a way. That little impossible detail on the cover.
It often is. Mm-hmm. These calculated little oddities, these impossible footnotes, they are frequently the stickiest parts of a legend. They're what makes a story durable, memorable, shareable.
So the record is album released, creepy lyrics, public calls police.
Right, verifiable actions and reactions.
But the legend is turbocharged by that impossible date stamp. October 32nd.
It's the signature that ensures the artifact, the album, will always be treated as something special, something otherworldly. It guarantees its place in the darker corners of popular imagination.
Okay, but then the story takes another sharp turn back towards reality, a really terrifying one, because this wasn't just fans getting spooked by weird lyrics and a fake date.
No. The authorities, specifically in Footman's hometown, they took those public calls seriously. Enough people were making connections, referencing the names on the tracks, that they launched a formal investigation.
So the police actually started looking into the album's claims.
They did. And according to the sources, what they found is the absolute linchpin connecting the art to the alleged crimes. It's the core claim of the whole Footman legend.
What did they find?
They started cross-referencing the names used as song titles on Guilty as Charged. They checked them against local police records, specifically missing persons reports from the previous year or so.
Hey.
And every single name matched. Every song title on the album was the name of a real person reported missing from the local area within the past year.
Whoa, okay. That's not coincidence. That's chilling.
Chilling is the word.
Yeah.
Suddenly, it's not just art imitating life or even just being creepy. According to these accounts, the album now looked like a deliberate, horrifyingly public catalog of victims.
Heart as evidence. Alleged evidence, anyway.
Alleged, yes. But the implication was overwhelming. He hadn't just confessed in code. He'd seemingly used his art as a final taunting gesture, like a diary of his supposed crimes put out there for everyone to buy.
Whether he actually did those things or not, just the fact of that correlation, the names matching missing people, that alone is terrifying.
It is. It gave the police, the press, and the public this horrifically concrete framework. The charming pop star was now potentially a serial killer confessing through his music.
The music wasn't entertainment anymore.
No. It became this permanent, deeply unsettling exhibit. Exhibit A, maybe. Mm. And it set the stage perfectly for the next act. The very public, very dramatic climax that the authorities were now planning.
They had a huge star as their prime suspect, and the public had this album, this source of dread, sitting in their living rooms. The tension must have been immense. Okay, so the police have this shocking correlation. The song titles matching missing people. The public is buzzing, probably terrified. What happens next?
Well, the authorities felt they had to act, and act fast. The pressure must have been enormous. You've got America's sweetheart possibly confessing to multiple murders on a hit record.
You can't just ignore that.
Absolutely not. So the sources described this plan they hatched for the arrest. And where did they decide to try and apprehend him?
Not at his home. Quietly.
Oh, no. In keeping with the theatrical nature of this whole saga, they planned the arrest during one of Harry Fitman's concerts.
Wow. Maximum drama. Maximum public spectacle.
Exactly. It transforms the arrest itself into this huge cultural event. The stage, his place of power and performance, was meant to become the scene of his downfall.
So the forces of law trying to reclaim the narrative right there in front of his fans.
That seems to be the idea. A very public rebuttal to his alleged private darkness. Staging it right there on the stage.
Yep, it didn't go according to plan, did it?
Not even close. The star, it seems, was one step ahead. As the police started to move in, maybe plainclothes officers trying to surround the stage area.
Yeah.
The sources claim that Footman, quote, somehow noticed them from a distance, before they even got close, before the trap was fully sprung.
How? How could he tell?
The sources don't specify. And that ambiguity is key, isn't it? It adds to his mystique. Was it just luck? Panic? Or did he have some kind of uncanny awareness?
The legend needs him to be more than just a regular guy who got spooked.
Precisely. For the myth to work, Footman can't just be a suspect reacting normally. He needs this almost supernatural foresight. He has to be smarter, quicker, more perceptive than the police.
To justify what happens next.
Which is, he immediately stops singing, bolts off the stage, and jumps into a car that was apparently waiting for him, ready to go.
And then the chase.
Oh, yes, the chase. And this wasn't some minor pursuit down a few city blocks.
Yeah.
The sources paint this picture of absolute pandemonium.
This is the 100 cop cars part.
That's the number that gets thrown around. A massive police chase, the reports say, with over 100 cop cars following Harry, supposedly across state lines.
100 police cars in 1937. That seems a lot.
It does seem like a lot, doesn't it? Let's pause there. As the mythologist, you see the incredible visual, the chaos.
Yeah.
Right? Perfect for the legend.
Totally. It's cinematic.
But as the methodologist, I have to ask, is that number 100 cars likely a literal verifiable fact? Or is it maybe journalistic hyperbole? Amplification to match the scale of the star and the alleged crimes.
Yeah, that makes sense. A small brief chase wouldn't fit the narrative, would it? It wouldn't feel like a fitting end for the Justin Bieber of the 1930s turned potential monster.
Exactly. You need the scale of the response to match the scale of the figure. 100 cars signals total state panic. The entire system mobilized against this one man. It cements the event as historic, epic, theatrical.
Whether it's really 100 or, you know, 20, the idea of this massive chase is what matters for the story.
Precisely. This exaggerated detail, this hyper record, it justifies the hyper celebrity they were chasing. And the chase itself, the sources say, lasted for 3 hours.
3 hours. The suspense must have been incredible. Radio updates, probably. People glued to their sets.
You have to imagine so. 3 hours of this high-speed drama unfolding until finally the car runs out of gas.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe breaks down. It coasts to a stop.
The end of the line.
That seems like it. The police cars, however many there actually were, surround the vehicle. The moment of capture feels absolutely inevitable. Tension off the charts.
They approach the car.
Carefully. Weapons drawn, you'd assume.
Right.
Ready to finally apprehend this singing sensation turned fugitive suspect.
But
he wasn't there. The car was empty. Harry Footman was gone.
Gone? How? From a car that had stopped, surrounded by police.
Vanished. Utterly. The man who led them on this epic chase just evaporated right at the climax.
Okay, that's the moment. That's where it leaves any kind of normal explanation behind.
Completely. It shifts from baffling true crime into pure, enduring folklore. The sheer impossibility of the escape guarantees the story survives. It demands explanation, but offers none.
Was there anything in the car? Any clue?
Yes. And it's perhaps the single most iconic, most bizarre detail of the entire legend. the final punctuation mark on his disappearance.
What was it?
The only thing the police found inside that empty car was a brick. A simple, ordinary brick resting on the accelerator pedal.
A brick? On the gas pedal? What does that even mean?
Who knows for sure? That's the power of it. It's his final, weird, deliberate gesture. What was it for? To keep the car rolling a little longer after he jumped out. To jam the pedal down.
Or just a message. A final taunting signature, like, I'm outsmarting you even now.
Could be any of those things. The brick suggests planning, right? Premeditation. It wasn't just a panic flight. It was an engineered escape. And leaving that brick, it replaces the man with this strange, inert mechanism.
It ensures the mystery isn't just that he vanished, but how. It leaves this concrete symbol of the impossibility.
Exactly. The physical substitute for his foot on the pedal. It's a final, almost artistic touch to an escape that already seemed impossible. It's the perfect, unsettling image to end the chase. So we need to state the outcome clearly, because it's the engine driving the whole enduring legend. Harry Footman was never seen again.
Never. After that chase, after the brick on the pedal. Nothing.
Nothing verifiable. Nobody ever turned up. No credible sightings were ever confirmed. No passport records, no trail. He just vanished into thin air. As the saying goes.
And that lack of an ending, that complete void where a resolution should be, it's perfect fuel for a myth, isn't it?
The most fertile ground imaginable. If he'd been caught, tried, convicted, or acquitted, the story would have an end. It would be tragic, maybe fascinating, but finished. Finite.
But because he disappeared.
The story becomes eternal. It's always open to speculation. Where'd he go? Did someone help him? Was he even real? The questions never stop. Because there's no final answer.
And the weirdest part? Maybe. The thing that keeps the story feeling weirdly current?
The music.
Yeah. The album, Guilty as Charged, the alleged confession, it didn't vanish with him.
Not at all. The sources we looked at mentioned this specifically. That album, those creepy songs with the names of missing people as titles, they still circulate. Apparently, you can even find them on, quote, modern streaming services, like Spotify.
Which is just wild to think about. Someone today, decades after all this happened, can just pull out their phone, tap a few times.
And listen to the exact same tracks that supposedly freaked people out so much in 1937 that they called the cops. The music that allegedly sparked that whole massive chase.
That confrontation is still possible. Direct. Immediate.
It's a really powerful demonstration of how cultural artifacts can persist, isn't it? Even when they're tied to these fleeting, dramatic, maybe even criminal events. The creator vanishes, but the creation remains.
And it acts as a witness, a constant, unsettling reminder of the story.
Exactly. The legend stays alive, in part because the music itself is still accessible. It's real. You can hear it. And that forces every new generation that encounters it to grapple with the story. Was he guilty? Did he really vanish like that? The music keeps the questions alive.
It validates the whole framework of the legend in a way. Even if you doubt the 100 cop cars or the impossible escape, the album itself exists. You can listen to it.
That accessibility turns those old, dusty rumors into something that feels like a contemporary record, a modern mystery you can engage with directly.
It's not locked away in some archive. It's potentially in your playlist.
Yeah.
Waiting.
Yeah. And that makes you confront the possibility.
Hmm.
Is this just music? Or is it something more? A document, like we said?
Allegedly a document of something truly dark.
If you think about cultural memory, the physical thing, the record, the stream, the file, it becomes the anchor. The man is gone. The events are debated, maybe exaggerated, but the artifact he left, that's concrete.
You can hear the mood, the chilling lyrics, and you instantly connect back to that historical dread, even if you're skeptical about the specifics of the chase.
Absolutely. The feeling persists because the source of the feeling persists.
So bringing it all together, this deep dive really shows that transition, doesn't it? We start with the record, a real person, Harry Footman, making music, then suspicion, investigation. Real-world stuff.
Mm-hmm. Grounded, however strange.
But then, through all those theatrical elements of the impossible date, October 32nd, the sheer, maybe exaggerated scale of that police chase.
100 cars.
And that final, unforgettable image of the brick on the gas pedal.
Can't forget the brick.
Through all that, the record seamlessly bleeds into legend. It becomes this compelling ghost story, a piece of modern American folklore that just refuses to die.
Those details, the impossible date, the brick, they function like signatures, don't they? Narrative signatures. They guarantee the story gets remembered and retold long after the news cycle moves on.
Because they're just too weird, too perfect, too memorable to be forgotten.
The artistry of the disappearance, you could almost call it, was maybe more effective at cementing his legend than any capture or trial or proven fact ever could have been. He wrote his own mysterious ending.
They're like the fingerprints the legend leaves behind, marking the story as something deliberately strange, purposefully unreal. #outro.
So wrapping up this deep dive, the whole Harry Footman story, it really offers some key insights, I think, especially if you're interested in how fame works, how myths get made.
What's the main takeaway for you?
Well, it clearly shows the power, the really unsettling power, of that confession album idea. The concept that art isn't just reflecting life, but might be actively, intentionally incriminating someone. That's potent.
Yeah, the idea that the art itself is the smoking gun.
Right. And maybe even more critically, it shows how those little glitches, those deliberate anomalies, the impossible details like October 32nd, how they are often the strongest glue holding a myth together. They're what allows a historical event to jump the tracks from fact into legend and stay there.
They make it sticky, unforgettable.
Exactly. Those impossible bits ensure its immortality.
And it really makes you think, doesn't it, about the connection between creators and what they create. How much of the stuff you consume every day, music, movies, books, online personas, carries the deep imprint, the psychological signature of the person who made it?
Mm-hmm. Even long after they're gone from the public eye. Hmm. Or maybe vanished completely, like Footman.
The art stays behind, like this weird living testament, and it forces anyone who encounters it years later to ask those uncomfortable questions. Who was this person? What did they really intend with this?
It keeps the mystery alive through the artifact.
Yeah.
And maybe the most enduring, the most unsettling thought to leave you with from that whole chaotic saga, the chase, the empty car, the mystery, is that the only thing we know for sure remained from that moment was the physical evidence left at the scene, that final strange object.
The car was empty, the needle still on the groove.